This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Last week, the United Nations released some rather startling projections concerning the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Based on a UN global policy model, the TPP will likely only bring minimal GDP growth to Malaysia's economy. And it's also predicted to lead to job losses and higher inequality. So joining me on the Breakfast Grill this morning to discuss this is economist Professor Jomo Kwame Sundram.
Good morning, Melissa.
Now, the projections of the UN global policy model seem to fly in the face of everything that the government has been telling us about the economic benefits of the TPP. Tell us why you argue that we will see limited economic benefits from this deal.
In fact, the findings of the UN global policy model are not all that radically different from the findings of the more standard computable general equilibrium models which have been touted. We do expect some increases in trade all around. Where we disagree is on the question of whether or not trade necessarily increases growth. And again, the standard CGE models are not predicting a huge increase in growth, but our models suggest a greater degree of pessimism. But the real stark difference is on whether or not what you think about employment. And the standard CGE models, which are the basis of most of the work, assume full employment. The UN model does not assume full employment, and we expect that there will be not only modest growth, if any, and in fact we expect that in the case of the US as well as Japan, there may well be an economic contraction, not huge, but certainly not insignificant, over the 10-year period. The growth projections we expect are modest for the various countries concerned, but more disturbingly, we find that there is likely to be some increase in unemployment. Again, not huge, but this is sobering. So the claimed gains for both growth as well as employment are much more somber in the case of the UN model predictions compared to the standard projections. It's also important to point out that even with the standard models, there are different estimates of likely growth.
Not to get too technical about it, but the CGE model, that is the model that most of the surveys or the studies have been based upon. So the Peterson Institute study, the PricewaterhouseCoopers studies as well?
Yes. It's a standard model. It's also used by the United States Department of Agriculture's Economic Research Service. They too, using a standard CGE model, come to fairly pessimistic findings about the increase in trade, particularly, of course, for the U.S. But more importantly, they come to the conclusion that there will be very negligible growth coming from this round of trade liberalization. But the big difference between the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Peterson model is that the Peterson model expects there to be considerable growth coming not from trade liberalization, but rather from a big increase in foreign direct investment. And this is an issue which is not addressed by the other work, including the UN's work. There is no way to speak with any certainty about how a trade liberalization model would actually contribute to increased investments, let alone foreign direct investments. So the attribution, the source of this growth from foreign direct investment is related to huge assumptions made about how the other aspects of the TPPA, the non-trade aspects, will ostensibly contribute to increase investments and increase in growth according to the Peterson model.
What non-trade aspects specifically?
Well, they come to the conclusion that with stronger protection for intellectual property rights, and especially for an investor state dispute settlement scheme to be introduced, plus other aspects of the TPP. One has to remember that the TPP is about 6,300 pages long, and most of it has got nothing to do with trade. We have been debating the part of the iceberg above the water, focusing on the trade aspects, but 8/9 of the iceberg is below water, and we have largely ignored any discussion of it. The USDA, which is the only official US estimate on this, is not as optimistic about the likely investment effects as well as the likely growth effects. And if one looks very carefully at the Peterson model, they make some heroic assumptions. Now, more recently, the World Bank has made even more heroic assumptions by using a different base year. The good thing about the World Bank's updating, which is again done by the same authors as the Peterson Institute, Professor Petrie and his colleagues, they have updated the base year. So the original projections of the Peterson Institute were done with 2007 as the base year. The new projections are done with 2011 as the base year. But they make heroic assumptions, and this is due to the different situation which prevailed in the OECD countries, the developed countries of the world, in 2011 compared to 2007. In 2007, there was fairly rapid growth by OECD standards, at least, in much of the North Atlantic region. In 2011, there was the leftover effects of the initial response to the economic slowdown following the financial crisis of 2008-2009. So by projecting from those numbers, they are very, very optimistic about growth. What we have actually seen, however, since the initial response to the financial crisis has been an austerity campaign in much of Europe, and this has slowed down economic growth. So outside of Germany and one or two other countries, there's actually very little growth going on in Europe, and in fact some degree of economic contraction. And so the basis for the World Bank's new numbers are very dubious. But most importantly, the World Bank has not published the technical basis for their enthusiastic endorsement of the TPP.
No. Why not?
Well, I have no idea why not. Perhaps Professor Petrie and company are checking the numbers, or there may well be. I'm not suggesting any sinister motive. Okay. And the growth which is predicted is very uneven. So, for example, that same paper has been used in Australia to urge many people, legislators in Australia, to reject the TPP because
it's so minimal.
The growth projections for Australia are just barely above zero.
That there are some proponents for the TPP who argue, look, 3% growth for a developing country is better than the current trajectory that we're on. So 10 years down the line, if we get an additional 3% growth, is that too bad? I mean, should we be opting out of that?
Melissa, it's not 3% per annum. It's 3% over 10 years. It's a cumulative effect of 3% over 10 years. So per annum, it is going to be less than 0.3%. Okay, so let's put this in perspective. Now, I think it is very important for us to look beyond the figures. Where is the growth for the developing countries going to come from? It's going to come from further primary commodity production. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was a young student in school, almost half a century ago, Malaysia was known as a major exporter of rubber and tin. Despite the growth of manufacturing industry which has taken place, Malaysia's major exports and income earners today are oil and palm oil. So we have come some way but not a long way. Many Malaysians are very concerned, quite correctly, about being stuck in what is called a middle income trap. How do we get out of a middle income trap if we do not get into much more value-adding activities? Now, sure, there are prospects for papaya exports and a bunch of other exports from Malaysia, but most of the exports are going to come from primary production. And who knows? Are we going to be very competitive in papayas with compared to, say, Cambodia or Laos, let alone Vietnam? Is that what we want to go? Is that the future we envisage for ourselves? My concern is that we need to go beyond simply debating whether or not there's going to be increased trade. I am the first to concede that there will be increased trade, because increased trade basically means two things: that you're going to increase exports and you're also going to increase imports. The question is, what is the composition of the exports which we are going to increase, and what is the composition of the imports which we're going to increase? So if we are going to increase more primary production and decrease production of more sophisticated goods or more value-adding goods, that would, in my mind, represent a setback. And this is why I'm concerned, and I've tried to shift the debate away from the trade focus of the current discussion to considering the developmental aspects of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because it's not just an agreement involving trade, and we have to pay far, far more attention to the other aspects of the TPPA.
Professor, I'd like to touch back on what you just mentioned about the developmental aspects of the TPP. What do you think are some of the areas that haven't been fully discussed about the impact of the TPP?
Well, I'm afraid most of the TPP have not been discussed very seriously. Much of the discussion and the debate has been over whether we trade more or we don't trade more. And that's a non-issue. Everybody agrees that we are going to trade more. The question is whether trading more means we are going to grow more and what the nature of that growth is going to be. And this is where my concerns are. I'm also concerned about who benefits from growth. If you have growth which primarily benefits others, it doesn't necessarily improve Malaysia's condition. It does not necessarily mean that Malaysians would be better off in the medium and longer term. This is my concern, because we have quite correctly become interested in what is called the middle income trap. And we are concerned about where future growth is coming from. We do not seem to have developed the technical capacities or the entrepreneurial and organizational capacities to move fast forward in the way, for example, that the Republic of Korea and Taiwan and so on and so forth have successfully been able to do. So what have we failed to do, and how do we make up for those failures? I'm not convinced that the TPP provides us the means to overcome the major impediments to our future growth in a way which is very convincing to not only myself, but having talked to a few medium-sized businessmen, mainly. I've only been back for a few weeks, so I haven't talked to all that many, and I'm not claiming that they are necessarily a representative. There are very many legitimate concerns, and this is why I am concerned that we are rushing the process. There's nothing to be gained by rushing the process. In fact, I would strongly urge all concerned to have a much more careful scrutiny of the documents and the implications, to engage people who are much more, who understand these issues much more than myself. For example, some of the legal issues are very, very complex, and the implications are very, very serious, and I cannot claim any expertise in those kinds of issues. But we need to have a discussion and go into disagreement with our eyes wide open. Already we know that the U.S. Senate leader will not allow the issue to come up during the rest of the Obama presidency. We also know the new government of Canada is not comfortable with the TPPA as approved by the previous government, and the minister concerned has called for a review, a careful, critical review of the TPP. We also find that in other parts of the world, there are some very important questions which are being raised. The fact that, you know, you have a politician or two or three or four who says that, you know, the TPPA is the greatest thing since sliced bread, and they all are interested in joining, one should ask the question, why now? Why didn't they participate in the discussions from the beginning? Because many of these people whom we are quoting and we are publicizing are people who had the opportunity of participating from the outset, and they chose not to. I can understand why, for example, in the case of Indonesia, President Joko Widodo chose not to, because he had just come into office, and he comes from a country and a party which has a strong nationalist tradition, and they may have been much more circumspect. But why would a very pro-US regime in the Philippines, for example, choose not to participate? Or a very, very open economy like Thailand, why did the Thai government choose not to participate? So it's very important for us to put aside this simple pro and anti kind of debate which is taking place. Right. Let's look at this legislation much, much more carefully. Let's look at the implications of this discussion much more carefully, not rush into declaring there's nothing to be gained by being the first to approve the TPP. Let us look at it very carefully. Already, according to the Pew Research Center, Malaysia has the highest level of opposition or skepticism about the TPPA. Only 38%, I think, actually support the TPPA. And this is the lowest among the TPPA countries. So obviously, there is some disquiet. And let us address the concerns. Some of the concerns may be erroneous. Some of the concerns may be quite illegitimate. But let's stop this debate, which is not very productive, over issues which are non-issues or relatively less important issues, and let's focus on the very important implications of the very wide-ranging and comprehensive commitments which are involved in the TPPA.
Professor, why do you think we're rushing to sign this?
Well, I've just come back beginning of the new year, so I honestly don't quite fully understand what are the political and other aspects of this. I really don't see the rush, and I do hope that the government will reconsider the need to rush into this and take a much more careful and circumspect a step back. I think it is heartening that the minister concerned, Dato' Mustafa, has pointed out that we can opt out. But I think one has to recognize that opting out has costs as well. So rather than opting in and then opting out, let's not rush. Let's look at this very, very carefully. Let's have the kind of serious discussion which I'm sure Dato' Mustafa would also contribute to and benefit from, and consider the options open to Malaysia before committing ourselves to a situation which I fear will not be in Malaysia's medium and long-term interests.
Do you think that the TPP will help address issues of poor governance, of corruption and abuses in the Malaysian economy simply by ratifying to international standards?
Firstly, there are no international standards per se. Okay, these are standards which are being imposed by the corporate advisors, and there were well over 500 of them out of the 700 advisors to the US negotiating team. Over 500 were from large US corporations. Okay, only a few, relatively few were from other groups, and they often did not participate in many of the detailed drafting and negotiations. People are not interested in, nobody involved is seriously interested in getting rid of corruption. They want to eliminate the cost of corruption to their own companies, but they're not interested in getting rid of corruption. So if you can eliminate that by having a one-stop agency or some other mechanism, that will more than satisfy them. So this illusion that problems of corruption, problems of the abuse of affirmative action or abuse of other powers will somehow or other be addressed by the TPP, it's a lot of wishful thinking. It's very sad that I've spoken to so many people who actually think the TPP is all the things they want it to be, rather than actually taking a close look as to what it is likely to be, given what the agreement contains. There's also this naive view that there are these huge trade barriers. It is true that before the 1960s, the U.S. was a relatively closed economy. But beginning with President Kennedy, the U.S. became a relatively much more open economy. And Malaysia has, from colonial times, also been a very open economy. So these are two relatively open economies without any history of conflict and dispute. So it's not a question of addressing those various historical or other political problems. There are no serious problems which exist between Malaysia and the United States, for example, which are going to be resolved by this. Malaysian palm oil can hardly sell in the United States, but that is a non-tariff barrier. That issue is not going to be resolved by the TPP. So to reduce the tariff barriers from, let us say, from a notional 2% to zero, what does it do? In his State of the Union address, President Obama said that taxes would be reduced for 18,000 items. That's true. How many of those 18,000 items does Malaysia export? And how many of those 18,000 items, for that matter, does the U.S. export? Less than half. But even if we take the other remaining half, we find that only a small proportion of that remaining half is actually exported by the U.S., unless you want to look at the number of snow ski boots which are imported by Brunei or Malaysia. I seriously doubt they even come to 100,000. So I think there are a lot of assumptions which are actually not grounded in fact. I think there is far too little attention to the problems involved in the non-trade aspects of the TPP. Let me give you an example which I think bothers me a great deal. The question of intellectual property rights. There was a recent case where Martin Shkreli raised the price of a drug, an important life-saving drug, by 60 times. He claimed that this was necessary to develop new drugs. And in fact, there is no evidence that he invested even a cent in any research. But he claimed this. The U.S. Attorney General has finally prosecuted him, arresting him last month, and is beginning prosecution against him. What is it for? It's for running a Ponzi scheme. He cannot be prosecuted on the abuse or price gouging in relation to the abuse of the intellectual property rights which he holds. This shows you how vulnerable we are. If a company, if another Shkreli decides to raise the drugs which we are importing from the United States, we have absolutely no recourse, even under U.S. law. President Clinton found this out himself, so much so that he registered a patent. He bought two patents for antiretroviral drugs, and he registered them in India to enable those drugs to be manufactured in India and to be sold at prices he could control in Africa. Okay? Because he realized that the system in the U.S. was not amenable to addressing this problem. Let me give you another example, which is equally troubling. The largest selling herbicide in the world was revealed to be carcinogenic some time ago and designated as such by the World Health Organization. WikiLeaks exposed the fact that the U.S. Department of Agriculture had suspected as much from the 1970s. This information has not been used, has not been made available to other countries, including Malaysia. That particular herbicide continues to be widely used in this country. If the Ministry of Agriculture or the Ministry of Health or some other appropriate ministry decides to ban the use of that herbicide in this country, not only would we be liable to continue to care for the victims of the use of that herbicide, but we would also have to compensate that manufacturer for the loss of expected profits from the sale of what is clearly toxic and dangerous.
This is because of the investor-state dispute mechanism.
Yes, the investor-state dispute settlement arrangements allow people to companies to sue governments for any number of things, including what they deem to be expected profits. Similar suits have been conducted against a company called Peter Stuyvesant, against the Australian government. They managed to lose that, but this is part of the reason why Australians are outraged about the TPPA. Of course, to be fair, the TPPA does allow for a carve-out for tobacco. But what about other toxic materials, such as the ones I described earlier? It is true that the US has never lost such a suit so far, but it is now going to be sued by the company which was supposed to build the oil pipeline from Alaska to the rest of the continental United States. And this might well be the first case which the U.S. government may well lose. And by the way, these decisions are binding, and they will be made by panels. Okay? They will be made by panels. They're not, in other words, they will not be subject to the laws of the land concern. Okay? This basically allows the plaintiff to bypass the laws of the land. So this case will not be heard in the courts of Malaysia or any other country. Now, of course, they are claiming, oh, Malaysian courts, you know, you've got the best system of justice, money can buy, and so on and so forth. But they are also demanding the same in Europe. Of course, the Europeans are outraged by this. But this is the kind of thing which is happening. This is part of the reason why many of the medium-sized businessmen I'm talking to have told me their European partners are complaining to them that we have given in too easily on many of these issues, and they are very concerned because it sets a very dangerous precedent for Europe in its negotiations with the US. So there are huge implications involved in these negotiations, which unfortunately the current level of discourse, which has been mainly focused on things like trade and NEP, have really obscured. And we do so at great risk to the future of our country.
Well, Professor, the TPP goes for tabling and debate in Parliament next week and voting in Parliament as well. What is it that we can do to relook this document in greater detail?
I do hope that Minister Datuk Mustafa and Prime Minister Najib will continue with the debate next week, but have an open-ended debate which will continue perhaps over the course of 2016. Encourage greater consultation. Try to understand why there is such great skepticism in Malaysia towards the TPPA, and try to address the concerns which members of the public have, whether rightly or wrongly.
I've been speaking to Professor Jomo Kwame Sundram. Thank you so much for being on The Breakfast Grill today.
You're most welcome.
I'm Melissa Idris for BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.